Welcome to the MRI Cast. These podcasts focus on various current topics in MRI. We invite you to ask questions via the website and even suggest topics for future MRI casts. The opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect standards in clinical practices, nor should they be considered as medical advice. Well, hello everyone. I'm Bill Faulkner and welcome to this MRI cast. This is part of a series of seven MRI casts on the topic of gadolinium-based contrast agents. We'll be peeling back the gadolinium-based contrast agents, if you will, taking a little deeper look. This series is sponsored by an unrestricted educational grant from Bracco Diagnostics, and we certainly appreciate their support. Well, today's topics are really going to be a potpourri of topics about gadolinium-based contrast agents. And with us is our potpourri expert, Dr. Jeff Mackey. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Bill. How you doing? I've been called a lot of things, but never a potpourri man before.
Wow. Well, you know, it's a new day. It's a new day. And speaking of experts, I had heard an expert being defined, X being a has-been, a spurt being drip under pressure. Dr. Howard Raleigh, how are you, sir?
Well, thank you so much for that introduction, Bill. I'm not so much an expert as I am a master of pandemic puppies right now.
That's great. And also Kristen Harrington. Hello, Kristen.
Hey, everybody. So I guess I'm the master of homeschooling right now and virtual learning. And I really think that, Jeff, how do you smell since you're the potpourri of the group?
Oh, very, very lovely, I would say, kind of flowery and quite like a spring day.
I was getting that vibe. So, okay, we're all good.
What was it, that Irish spring curve, sort of a manly yes, and I like it too, or something like that from years ago. Anyway, Jeff, since your first time on the MRI cast with us, some people may not be familiar with where you are and what you've been doing. So tell us a little bit about yourself and what you've been doing lately.
Yeah. Okay, Bill. Glad to. I spent a lot of my early career at the University of Washington in Seattle and did a lot of vascular and cardiac work there. And about 3.5 years ago, I moved to the University of Colorado, where I took over as section chief of abdominal imaging and skiing and flying gliders and hiking and stuff, which is what's really, really fun about this place. But it's been a very nice change of pace to move to a different place and to kind of experience a different type of department and a different kind of physical environment around me. And I really love it here. I'm getting to do a lot more body things, a little bit less vascular things, but I'm still doing my vascular work and MR lymphangiography and things like that. But I've been having a lot of fun here in Denver, which is really a nice place to be, I gotta say.
How's it been going for you with, well, the pandemic and all the, I know for us, we were doing a lot more stuff virtual, and is it kind of affecting you that way as well?
We've been pretty locked down here. As a matter of fact, we're doing a lot of, you know, pretty much as everyone is doing everything virtually and by Zoom, kind of like we're doing this virtually, although that's one of the advantages of the pandemic is that we're all learning how to do these virtual interactions a lot better. And that just kind of reminds me of a funny thing that happened early on in the virtual world here, which is that I was giving a noontime lecture to the residents, and normally you'd be standing in a conference room, but in the time of COVID, you know, I'm sitting at my computer here at home, and they're all spread all over the place on Zoom. And I had like 25 residents logged in there, and everyone was doing just, it was going well. I gave a really nice talk, I thought. And, you know, sometimes when you're talking, you're just on a roll and everything, it just feels like, oh, this is the clearest I've ever expressed this. And I get to the end after about 50 minutes and I say, so are there any questions? Dead silence. And then I look at this little thing up in the corner of the Zoom, which kind of had this little indication like the whole thing might not be actually broadcasting anymore. And then I pick up my iPhone and I look, and there's a bunch of messages there from 1 minute into the talk saying, Dr. Mackey, you cut out. You're no longer there. Are you still, can you log back on? And I'd never noticed that. So I gave a 50-minute talk, to myself, but I did learn a lot from it.
I started to say, how did you enjoy it?
It was one of my best talks.
Did you get
ever,
good reviews?
An N of one, yes.
Well, I would certainly give myself a top review on that. Let's start talking about the gadolinium agents. And one of the things that came to mind that I'd like to get, since we've got several people on here, I'd like to get everybody's opinion on this or take on it. The ACR and the FDA differ on their stance on checking for renal function. Is that right? I mean, do I understand that correctly? I know the FDA pretty much says that you should, and the ACR says, you don't really have to. What's your guys and y'all's view on that?
No, I think that's exactly right, Bill. the ACR, I think, has a bit more updated guidelines than the FDA. And as you know, the ACR breaks things down into groups one, groups two, and group three, depending on the type of contrast and what they see as the level of risk. And group one and group three agents, which, you know, group one, as we know, are Omniscan and MagnaVist and OptiMark, and group three, which is EOVISC, they do recommend that patients are screened for a history of kidney disease. And that's because those agents are the ones that are more likely to cause things like NSF or more likely to be associated with gadolinium retention. But they single out the group two agents, which are Multihance, Prohance, GadaVist, and Dotarem, as being agents that don't necessarily need to be screened for. And they kind of consider it optional. And that's because those agents really have essentially no NSF associated with their use. And also, certainly the macrocyclic agents, and to some degree also the linear agent Multihance, seem to have significantly less gadolinium retention. The FDA kind of doesn't really break things down into groups like that, but they are more kind of along the lines of saying that we suggest you screen for all patients and don't use the things that the ACR considers group one agents, namely Omniscan, MagnaVist, and OptiMark, in patients with chronic or severe kidney disease. So it's a little bit less specific of a guidance that we get from the FDA. Is that your understanding as well, Howard?
Yeah, in general, that's exactly right. Although there's one other kind of angle to this that it puts us in a bit of a bind, which is since the FDA also requires that we hand out the medication guide to patients coming in, it says that your renal function will be checked. And of course, we're not checking because we're using a group two agent, gadobenate or Multihance most of the time. And we think that that's well supported. And the ACR says that's appropriate. But, you know, if luckily none of the patients, as far as I can tell, actually read the medication guide that we're handing out. And we also sort of, we give the perspective of the medication guide by having the other side of the sheet of paper say something like about your MRI exam, and we discuss what to expect, including you may give contrast, and we've chosen the agent for you, and there's more information on the other side. And I haven't had a single person ask, or to my knowledge, in tens of thousands of cases since we started handing out the medication guide, nobody's said, hey, this says we're supposed to have our renal function check, and you didn't check it. So, I think we're doing the right thing by not, having more blood draws or point of care EGFRs, since we're using a group two agent.
Kristen, it's a facility where you work. Do they check renal function? It's more pediatric, but do they routinely check renal function?
No, they do not. It would be a very specific situation, but no, they do not.
Do they give out the medication guide?
No, they do not.
I know
we've talked to some to give it out the first time. And also realize I'm PRN, and I used to work maybe 3 days a year. I've been there almost 13 years, I think. But and I used to work a lot more, but now I work so little. But the new patients that we have, we do not give them the medication guide. So,
And it's, speaking of the medication guide, we had somebody, I don't know, we were doing a course, and somebody made the comment about well, every time we give out the medication guide or something, we've had a lot of, they've had a lot of people say refuse the GAD or ask a lot of questions about it. And I've always been of the mind that the FDA says you are to give the patient a medication guide, but they don't say, point it out to them, read it to them, question them on it. They just say, give it to them. And do y'all think that that makes a difference? I mean, if it were me, I mean, I'm not an active practice, but if I were managing an imaging center again, with the radiologist approval, I would just say, we're just going to give it to them. Just slide it across with all the other paperwork and don't necessarily point it out to them.
Well, you know what? I can comment on this because I have a ton of kids and, I don't read any of the paperwork and I just, you know, I'm this straight line drawer. I just, because they still ask me all the questions when I take my children back. So if I were to receive a medication guide, I don't think that I would read it. I don't think we need to point it out. I think that it should be given. And I have to make a clarification. I work between two outpatient facilities, and I don't know if the hospitals are giving out the medication guide. So I don't know how every facility is actually handling that situation.
Howard, Jeff, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I could make a couple quick comments on this. You know, I think it's the May 2018 update that the FDA said that, we all need to provide to first-time outpatients this kind of medication guide, which the FDA has provided. And, you know, it's a real struggle, I think, in different institutions trying to figure out how to do this. I mean, at my institution, the first thing they did is they started to hand it out via the check-in process. So the people that were checking in the patient would basically hand them this form. And that just didn't work out real well because there were questions that happened and they were kind of in the wrong place, namely in the waiting room and that sort of thing. And the group of people that did the checking in and of the patients kind of revolted and said, look, we're not going to do this. So it went down to the technologists then who would hand this form out. And they, you know, we're in a place, a tertiary care center, and most of our patients have had MRIs before. So the vast majority of them, because this is only mandated to be given with the first gadolinium administration, don't end up getting this. But the ones that do, they get it. And, you know, it can be a real logistical problem because I was just talking to the techs the other day and I was kind of asking them, you know, is this something that slows the process down? And they say about 50% of the patients just like drop it in the nearest trash can and don't look at it, kind of like Kristen is saying, you know, because there's so much stuff you get at the hospital, you just can't look at it all or digest it all. But of the 50% that read it, you know, a lot of them have questions and the techs do the best they can to answer them. And usually, you know, 5 minutes, maybe at the worst 10 minutes, they can kind of get these things settled. Very rarely they'll have to call in a radiologist. Now, I will admit that I think the techs kind of they sometimes kind of forget to give this form to the patients, but I think they try by and large. But it's, you know, I think it's nice for the patients to have that information. I think it, you know, even the way it's written though, it can be tough for patients to really understand. And I'll just say one other thing though, you know, the other thing that we've done is there is a clause in there for inpatients in particular, which says that something, if the physician thinks this would cause undue stress, that we don't have to provide this to the patient. So we kind of made an executive decision among our MR safety committee that there would be undue stress to our inpatients. So we don't actually provide this to our inpatients. And kind of like Howard, we also use a group 2 agent entirely, mainly gadobenate. So we don't do the screening either for outpatients. Although if we happen to know that their GFR is less than 15, then we withhold at that point.
Did you say less than 15?
Less than 15, exactly.
Let's so talk about that a little bit. Yeah.
So that's your don't bug me number?
That's our don't bug me number for group 2 agents.
And so how did you come to that decision, Dr. Mackey? How did you come to that decision that 15 would be your cutoff? Because I hear people say all different types of numbers, okay, when it's below 30 or, you know, so on and so forth. So how did you come to, I know using a group 2 agent, but is that the reason why, or how did you come to that?
Well, this is, you know, something that our MR safety committee looked at pretty carefully and looked at the fact that there really are, you know, at most a number of cases you can count on one hand that have of NSF that have happened in patients that have received group two agents, and that the risk is very, very low. I mean, we obviously, anytime we know somebody has renal insufficiency, we try to make sure that the gadolinium is really justified and that there isn't some other test that could answer this more carefully. But with, you know, we feel there's a lot of patients that can really benefit from gadolinium with a GFR between 15 and 30. And, you know, going down to 15 and probably even going down well below 15, there's a lot of nice studies with group two agents and patients with on dialysis, et cetera. And there's really never been an unconfounded case with maybe one or two possible exceptions. So we really feel that it's beneficial to, you know, not have the radiologists and teams get all excited when the GFR is 18 or 21 or something, and there become all kind of phone calls and people are saying, you know, can't we, do we need to consent, not. So we drop that number down to 15 and feel pretty safe about that. And it does give a lot of our patients access to having contrast studies that might otherwise either take a lot of time for people for radiologists and clinicians to talk back and forth about it, or, just not be able to be done. And we haven't seen any problems with this that we're aware of.
That's good to know.
Yeah. Howard, what's your don't bug me number?
Well, we don't have a don't bug me number. We take another philosophy, which is we protocol every case. We make sure gadolinium is justified in every case. And we'll take any EGFR. And I think that's justified by the data for group two agents. You know, that's for our hospital and outpatient practice. The VA, I think, last time I checked, still requires that we go over and actually physically meet the patient and consent if it's below 30, which I think is kind of overkill if you're using, you know, multi-hands or one of the other group two agents. And just to comment on the medication guide, we make a good faith effort to give it out, but I think it really, really helps to make it literally a two-page thing where the front side tells you about the MRI and what to expect and puts in perspective why we're giving you gadolinium and that we've carefully thought about it. And there's more information on the other side. And, you know, nobody reads that. It's sort of like when you go to Walgreens and you get your script and they staple it on and the first thing you do is rip that off and throw it away. You know,
that's funny thing about that, because I remember when the medication guide deal first came out, everybody was just freaking out because a medication guide, you know, what happened with Medicaid? What is this? And, you know, it's to your point, it's the thing you staple onto a bag. You know, that's what it is. My wife got one the other day. I got a picture of it. I should send you this picture of it. You know, those maps you used to get at a gas station or something to travel, like Tennessee, Georgia, and Florida map. It was literally about that size. The thing was huge.
A triptych.
Yeah.
You know, well, I do think, though, I actually feel better about handing it out. I don't want to give anybody the sense that we're hiding anything. And I think there are a few patients who are going to read that. And I think more information, the better. Let them ask their questions. And we just haven't seen any issues with it in our practice, you know, to speak of.
Well, that's some great discussion. Let's move on to a discussion of body MRI, and in particular, liver imaging. And I want to start with a little background for the listeners, in case there are people that are new to or maybe not familiar with MR imaging of the liver. Well, first, it's well accepted that dynamic contrast enhancement is really essential for liver imaging. And we have two types of agents that are available. One is the standard extracellular fluid space agent, which is really non-specific for any particular body part. And these ECF agents are cleared from the body by the kidneys. And then you have agents which have biliary excretion. Eavist has 50% biliary excretion because portion is taken up by functioning hepatocytes, and Multihance has 4% biliary excretion. So both agents can be used for arterial phase imaging as well as delayed so-called hepatobiliary phase imaging. So, Jeff, I'd like to start with you and ask you to give us your view and strategies on agent selection and use.
Yeah, absolutely, Bill. This is a great topic. I think one of the things you've got to do first is talk about what type of disease you're looking for in the liver. So a lot of what we do with MR is looking at cirrhotic livers and looking for hepatocellular carcinoma. And for that particular exam, the dynamic exam is really the absolute key, because what you're looking for are lesions that have arterial enhancement typically, and then wash out. And the second type of exam that we're often doing, particularly in patients with malignancy, is what we call more of a detection exam, where we're trying to find, say, colorectal or melanoma metastases or something. And in that case, it's not so much about looking for things that are arterial enhancing, because most, not all metastases, but most are relatively hypovascular, but it's about finding these kind of little stealth lesions that might make a difference to the surgeon, who might, you know, resect one or two, you know, metastases in the liver if they could find them. And then I guess there's a third thing that we're often doing with liver as well, which is characterization. You know, you have some sort of a lesion, and is it an adenoma? Is it an FNH? Is it some sort of funny atypical hemangioma? And this is often, again, in a patient with some sort of malignancy, and you're just not sure. So, you know, that's kind of breaking it down into these, you know, what my view would be, these kind of three broad categories. And we have a different approach for each one. So certainly for the cirrhotic patient in whom we're looking for hepatocellular carcinoma, we tend to use an extracellular agent, and we, you know, multi-HAMPS or gadobenedate is what we use at our institution. And it works very nicely. It's got a little bit more relaxivity than the other agents. There have been some studies that indicate that it may enhance hepatic lesions a little bit more. And then, but it's a very typical agent, so it's kind of hypervascular and washout. Some people do use EVIST for hepatocellular carcinoma, but we've kind of found it can be very tricky, because you don't get as much arterial enhancement typically, because it's given at 1/4 the dose that all of the extracellular agents are given at. It's given at 0.025 millimoles per kilo, which means you have a much smaller bolus. It's a little bit harder to hit that arterial phase. And that's probably people's biggest complaint about it, is that you just don't get that same kind of arterial phase hyper enhancement that you might see with extracellular agents. And then the other issue with EVIST for cirrhotic patients is that you don't really have what we call a true washout phase. It's kind of this transitional phase where the hepatocytes, even 2-3 minutes in, when you're thinking of a typical washout, the hepatocytes are starting to really take this contrast up. The background liver is getting bright. And, you know, what washout is a little bit harder to tell. And I will just make the comment here that a lot of times, you know, a lot of institutions will give larger doses of EVIST. I know several places that will actually double the dose of EVIST, mainly to get that arterial phase enhancement. We actually don't do that. We do stick to ACR doses. And if your timing is good, it usually works pretty well. But as I say, we're not using EVIST for our cirrhotic patients. We're using an extracellular agent. And where we like to use EVIST is what we call kind of the detection. So I kind of mentioned that, but a lot of times you will find lesions, and it's very well demonstrated in multiple publications that probably the best way to find small metastases, multiple metastases, is in the hepatobiliary phase. And EVIST is the agent that does that very, very nicely. So you look 15 to 20 minutes after, and you will find lesions that you might miss with a conventional agent in an earlier delayed phase, or with EVIST in an early phase. You'll find them very nicely in that hepatobiliary phase, where the liver has gotten very, very bright. The background parenchyma is bright, and the lesion is very, very dark. And we're actually doing an interesting study, Bill, that we're just getting going on, because you mentioned this, that multi-HAMPS or gadobenedate has a 4% hepatic uptake, basically. And there's a lot of nice early studies that show that after 90 to maybe 120 minutes, rather than 15 to 20 minutes with EOVIS, that there's a lot of hepatobiliary uptake with multi-hands. And we're actually doing a study in patients with colorectal cancer, doing a direct head-to-head comparison of looking at EOVIS at 15 to 20 minute delay versus multi-hands at 90 to 120 minute delay. And as I said, we haven't enrolled any patients yet, but we're just about to do that. So I think that'll be a very interesting test to kind of see how good those hepatobiliary aspects of multi-hands are. And just one more quick point I'll make. I mentioned that third type of characterization. You're trying to characterize a lesion. And there, it really requires a little bit of thinking, because one of the other nice things that hepatobiliary agents are good at is trying to get this distinction between FNH, focal nodular hyperplasia, and hepatic adenoma. And you know, while there's a little bit of controversy about how good we really are at doing this, the hepatobiliary assays will often really help you out there. But the caveat of that is EOVIS can be a difficult agent to characterize other things, even like hemangiomas, because you don't have that good vascular phase. And I've seen some people make some really big mistakes and call hemangiomas something else more ominous because they use EOVIS. So generally, if it's a first time trying to look at a liver lesion and we don't really know what it is, we're not in a cirrhotic patient, we're not, you know, in a patient with colorectal cancer or something, and we've got some funny lesion, I really like the extracellular agent as the first place to go. And then if after that you can't decide and you're thinking, oh, is it an FNH or an adenoma, then you may go to an EOVIS type exam.
You know, Jeff, that was the most thorough, erudite, expert answer I've ever heard. And I'd also like to point out,
you're gonna have to make me look up the word erudite.
Yeah, it proves the point. We haven't given up the filibuster yet, apparently.
And this coming from our expert here, right?
I'm dripping.
Well,
I'm totally lost. I think it's fantastic. I'm going to have to look up a lot of words as well. But I do have a question. It's not about contrast, and it's for you, Jeff, as well as for Howard. And I've got my pencil ready to write down those big words. And so anyway, how does diffusion play a part in all of this? And that's to either one of you.
I'll take the first swipe at that, because diffusion really started out in the brain, and it's basically run usually with an equiplanar sequence. You hang a pair of gradients on there called Stuskal-Tanner gradients. They dephase. You dephase, you rephase after a gap. And, you know, basically this sensitizes the sequence to the micromolecular movement of water. And it turns out it's a really good way to characterize different types of normal tissue and pathology, because highly cellular tumors, for example, get these packed cells that restrict the water motion. And to go to the bottom line, they tend to be bright on the diffusion-weighted images. So these have become, you know, completely standard. Every single brain that we do gets a diffusion-weighted image. And then the body guys like Jeff, you know, as usual, they wait for us to find really good stuff. And then they've adopted it, you know, for their own, you know, other use, that incidental use, like stuff like the liver. So
thank you for the actual physics explanation and how it all started with neuro. And maybe, Jeff, you could expand on the liver portion, the body portion.
No, absolutely. I mean, Howard's right. What we do is we let them do the easy things in brain, where things are nice and still, and we can stay as long as we want. And then we try to move them into the body, where things are flying around all the time. So the diffusion actually, I mean, just like Howard said, in the brain, diffusion is pretty much done on all patients. That is exactly the case in abdominal imaging as well, with a few exceptions, which probably don't really matter a lot. But in the liver, exactly as Howard explained, you have tumor cells that tend to behave differently. They're tighter packed. The diffusion is less within these. And therefore, if you turn on these Stuskal-Tanner gradients or other gradient paradigms that give you this diffusion weighting. And we often throw, we throw the number little b. So little b is a factor of how much diffusion weighting we're putting into our imaging. And when we kind of crank that b factor, which correlates to those gradients up, then the water that is not diffusing as rapidly stays brighter than the rest of the water. And it turns out in the liver, this is a really nice way to look for metastasis as well. So if we look at these high B-value diffusion weighted images, and you know, in our experience, it depends on your scanner, but a lot of times we just do these free breathing and we just do multiple averages, and that takes away the breathing component, which is another problem we have. There are other types of scanners and other sequences. You can do this in a breath hold, but we just like this, you know, multiple averaging. And we look at these high B values, and a lot of times we have these with our EOVIST exams as well, looking for metastasis, and it's really remarkable how well you can see them. So even if you don't use EOVIST and looking for colorectal cancer, say for instance, you know, metastasis, really we focus in on those diffusion sequences because they will allow you to find little teeny bright spots that are typically metastasis. Now, of course, you've got to look at everything else, look at your T2 weighted imaging and make sure you're not looking at a cyst with T2 shine through and things like that. But it is uncanny how well this works. And the other place that diffusion is nice is we usually do a relatively high B value, like 800 or maybe even 1,000.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask. That I was going to ask question, you what B value.
Yeah, I mean, B value the problem is the higher the B value you go, the less signal to noise you get. So we usually use 800 for most of our abdominal imaging, and that gives you very nice diffusion weighting. You can see things like adrenal and pancreas and spleen, which restrict nicely. The liver doesn't have much signal, not too much else has much signal. Metastases and lymph nodes will really pop out on those. And I tell all my residents, you know, when you're looking for lymph nodes in the abdomen, look at those high B value imaging. Because really the only thing that's bright are things that are restricting a fair amount, like metastasis or lymph nodes or some of these organs. And then sometimes you can have this entity I talked about T2 shine through or something that's very, very T2 bright, like a cyst, can still have signal, not because it has restricted diffusion, but because by definition, diffusion sequences are also T2 weighted sequences. But what I was going to say is another thing that can be really helpful is we also do a very low B value, like B50. And you have to have two different B values to get what they call the apparent diffusion coefficient map, which kind of helps you look at the diffusion if you care about quantifying it, which you sometimes do. But the point I was trying to make here is what that little bit of B does, that little diffusion, is it eliminates the signal from flowing blood. So if you look in the liver at the low B value image, typically the hepatic veins and the portal veins and the hepatic arterial signal is all very, very diminished. And it's still a very T2 weighted image. So it's kind of like a black blood T2 image. And you can often find metastasis, you know, hiding right next to vessels or things like that. So these are very routine sequences that the more you get used to using them and looking at them, the more helpful they can really be in your abdominal imaging.
I really had not heard that before about the low B value, but it makes sense. But that's, you know, and I've always wondered why a very low B value like that. And then that makes perfect sense. And the other thing is that, not to get too far off track here, because I want to get back to the contrast agents, because I think there's some really important points that we need to discuss. But the diffusion has been shown, whole body diffusion or body diffusion has been shown in many cases to be very similar to the information you can get with a PET scan. Is that not correct?
Yep. And especially if you do quantitative ADCs or apparent diffusion coefficient, and I've seen people do this whole body and then photographically invert it, it looks very much like a nuclear medicine scan. And you can follow at least some highly cellular metastases. You can diagnose them, then follow them. And usually as tumors get treated and start to melt away, the diffusion restriction that was previously there because of the high cellularity starts to reverse. And so it's a really sensitive way to go. And, you know, in the brain and spine and body, we use different B values. So everything's relative in the brain, people probably recognize the B value is 1,000 for sort of standard work. We'll go up to 2,500. But then you have problems with distinguishing diffusion restricting lesions from, say, just tight white matter tracts, so forth. So it depends on the body area, but I would say that Jeff's comments were trenchant. Trenchant. That's the word of the day. I'm trying to help you guys here.
You're killing me, Smalls. You're killing me.
Vocabulary builder.
Well, keep your eye on diffusion, because I think it's going to just keep getting bigger and bigger and more important as we look at different ways to really utilize it and have it help us. So.
Okay, moving back to contrast agents, I want to address a point that I think is very critical that everyone understands, and I've heard Jeff speak on this several times, and that has to do with breath holding, image quality related to breath holding. And one of the things I want to start with, and Jeff, let me give you this kind of as a start into this and see if this is as accurate as I understand it. In the ACR contrast media manual, there is a section, paragraph or so, specific to EOVIST, and it addresses a phenomenon that's been documented. I know I've seen several articles on this, where for whatever reason, following the injection of EOVIST for the arterial phase, people have this transient shortness of breath. And this has been shown to make it difficult for them to hold their breath. And of course, that creates a problem in the arterial phase. And I know you are a really strong component of having a very good arterial phase. That's like really the key to the whole thing. If you lose the arterial, I've heard you say you don't really have anything. So your thoughts or comments on that? Is that kind of still a correct view?
No, Bill, I think it absolutely is. It is a phenomenon, I believe they call transient tachypnea. And I think if you look at a couple of different papers, I can't remember the exact numbers, but 10 to 20% of the time, patients that get a bolus injection of EOVIST just feel this kind of feeling that makes them need to start breathing, and they feel like they can't hold their breath, and there's a little bit of a very strange sensation.
Jeff, is that immediate or is there a delay?
No, it's pretty immediate because it happens during the arterial phase. Okay. And this is my experience as well, is you look at a handful of a dozen EOVIST exams and, two or maybe three of them, it's just like the pre-contrast is fine. The portal venous is fine. The arterial phase is just wiped out because the patient is breathing. And that can be a real problem. But as I said earlier, it's like, with EOVIST, luckily, if we've done our triaging right and we're doing the right kind of contrast agent for the right type of patient, we're not doing cirrhotics and this sort of thing where the arterial phase is absolutely key. We're really using it more for that delayed phase. So it often doesn't kill you as long as you have the right patients. But it is a bit of a problem. And what I can tell you from having talked to some technologists that have worked through this is a lot of times it can be important to tell the patient up front, if they're getting EOVIST, that some people do experience this funny feeling of shortness of breath, and it's very rapid and it goes away very quickly, but be prepared that if that happens, and do your absolute best to realize it's going to get better very quickly and try to hold your breath while we're taking those arterial phase pictures. If you can communicate that to the patient somehow up front, I believe, and several other technologists that I've worked with believe, that you can probably you can probably get on top of that problem and at least have some of these patients get through the exam a little bit better.
I would find that totally believable. When we do lectures and in classes and stuff, and we talk about, for example, excuse me, contrast media adverse events, Kristen always says, you know, set realistic expectations with the patient. You know, we hear people say, you know, I give you an injection of contrast, oh, you won't feel anything. Well, that's not true. You do. And it has been my experience over the years that when you, I mean, you don't tell the patient you're going to, you know, feel nauseated. You basically just tell them you're going to feel a little flush feeling and it's normal, it'll pass. Things like this, and with the same way with this, with the breath holding issue, I believe that's a very, very wise thing to do, is just tell the patient up front, because you really do need to get the patient's cooperation on breath holding. Jeff, any other thoughts on holding your breath? I know I'd like to get your thought on this. As for me, I've always, when I've done breath holding for abdominal imaging, I've always do it on expiration. And I see many, many techs do this on inspiration. I've always been a big fan of expiration, because a patient will, and you can, everybody listening can try this, you'll hold your breath out the same amount every time, as opposed to taking a breath in. Sometimes you suck in half the air out of the room, other times it's a small one. But when you breathe out and hold it, it always seems to me to go to the same place in terms of respiration. Would you agree with that?
Oh, you're stealing my thunder here, Bill. That is exactly right. No, you're exactly right on there. I think it's important to realize that motion in abdominal imaging, unlike that easy stuff that Howard does where the brain more or less
stays still. It's brain, yeah. gray matter, white matter, CSF. That's really all right.
Never done, right? No, respiratory motion will kill exams. And I can't tell you how many exams I look at where the only sequences that are good are the T2 single shots, and everything else is just corrupted with motion. And a lot of times it's just your patient, but I think the technologist has a lot to do with this, as far as really, really working with the patient to try to get that breath hold happening, to try to get the scan time down to where they can breath hold. But as far as the inspiration versus expiration, I am a big fan of expiration as well. And another important point about expiration is you want to kind of train the patient is how to exhale. And if you tell the patient to blow their breath all the way out, you know, where you go, you blow it all the way out, that's a very hard position to hold and an unreliable position. But if you just say, take a breath in and then just gently let it out, that gets into a very reproducible place. There's still a fair amount of air in your lungs, and patients can still do a pretty good job of holding the breath. They probably can't hold it quite as long as they need or as they can with inspiration, but it's usually plenty long. And the point you made, Bill, is that puts all their intra-abdominal organs in kind of the same place. And that's really important, particularly for things like renal, where we might want to do some traction, because it can be kind of hard to tell whether things are enhancing or not. And if you have a lot of misregistration between your different phases, it can get really, I mean, first off, subtraction pretty much doesn't work at all, unless you have sophisticated algorithms to correct that. And second off, it just the whole morphology of the organs kind of change a lot, and it can be hard to kind of co-localize a lesion on one phase to another phase. So I really like that expiration, kind of with that, you know, just gently let the breath out until it's comfortably out, and then don't breathe. You know, that said, you know, sometimes patients can hold their breath for 2 seconds doing it that way. And the technologists, you know, need to work with them, and typically do work with them, to try to find the thing that works. And sometimes it is going to be inspiration. But, you know, we look at those multiple dynamics, and boy, the liver's like 2 centimeters higher on this scan than it is on that scan. And that's, you know, realize that can be a problem for us.
You know, I'm so glad as a neuro guy to hear you admit in public that there's basically no inspiration in body imaging.
It's an expired topic, what can I say?
That was brilliant, Howard. That was brilliant.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, that's great. Y'all are getting me today. At least you used a word I can understand. You know, I don't want to You know, as we kind of get close here to coming to the end, I want to bring up one topic that we've actually discussed a little bit in another podcast, but I know that Jeff, you have some experience with this, and that's with the use of SPiO, super paramagnetic iron oxide, particularly ferromoxytol, which I believe is the generic name. Ferraheme's the trade name, is that correct? And ferromoxytol is the generic chemical name of it.
That's correct.
What's your experience been with that? How have you used it, and what's your experience been? I'll ask about dosing and things like that, just so we can get some other opinions here on it.
Sure. Well, I have kind of a unique history of using ferumoxetol. I do a very specialized exam called MR lymphangiography. And what you do for that is you take a very small amount of gadolinium agent. You know, we typically use Multihance, but pretty much any extracellular agent will work. And you inject it between the web spaces of the either fingers or toes, depending on whether you want to look at upper or lower extremities. And you then follow the gadolinium, a fair amount of which gets taken up by the lymphatics. You follow it doing almost like an MRA type sequence, you know, a 3D gradient echo fat suppressed sequence of some sort, you know, up the arm or up the leg. The problem is that while some of the contrast goes into the lymphatics, a bunch of the contrast just goes into the venous system as well. So you get all these veins in addition to your lymphatics. So a technique that we figured out that works really, really nicely is we give the patient some ferumoxetol IV before the exam. And this is a blood pool agent. It has a half-life of about 15 hours. So once it's in the blood pool, it just stays there. And the other thing is, if you want to get into some physics, Howard, because of the iron nature of it, it has a very, very strong propensity to shorten the T2 star. So the T2 star gets very, very short. And with very normal doses, we can make the T2 star so short that we can eliminate all signal from the blood by using an echo time of 5, 6, 7 milliseconds, somewhere in there. So what we do is we do our MRL sequences looking for the lymphatics with slightly longer echo times. And because of that, we null everything that's in the blood, including the gadolinium, which kind of leaked into the blood, which we don't want to see. So we eliminate all the venous signal, and we get these really nice lymphatic maps of the extremities. So that works very nicely, but this has given us a lot of experience with ferumoxetol. And there's a couple things about this agent. I mean, it has a very good R1 relaxivity. So, you know, very similar, even quite a bit higher than a lot of agents, meaning it's got a very, it's very capable of shortening the T1 like gadolinium agents. But as I mentioned, it also shortens the T2 and T2 star a lot. So because of that, while there has been experience kind of doing a dynamic injection with this agent, most people don't do that. And the reason why is because there have been some problems with this agent as far as having some bad reactions to it that are felt to be largely related to bolus injecting. And the FDA has even come out and said with this agent that they really don't recommend that you bolus inject this agent. So it turns out that we can do a lot of very interesting imaging with it in its steady state. As I said, it has a 15-hour half-life. So once you get it into the body and into the bloodstream, that's where it stays. And you can use it the way we do to kind of null the blood by increasing that echo time. But you can also do steady state angiography with a much more normal, very short echo time. And there is so much R1 relaxivity or T1 shortening that, you know, this is fantastic for looking at, you know, the great vessels from the neck into the thoracic aorta and the subclavians, and looking for either arterial problems or venous problems there, or looking for venous problems in the legs. I know people like Paul Finn use this agent quite a lot for neonatal kind of total vascular exams. Another nice thing is it's iron instead of gadolinium, right? So the NSF problem doesn't exist. The renal failure problem doesn't exist. There's a lot of real benefits to this. And as I say, my main experience is using it for patients that are getting MR lymphangiography. But along the way, we've done, you know, a handful or two of patients for vascular indications in the steady state, and it works extremely well. And I'll give you a quick word about safety as well. There's a recent paper that just came out in Radiology where they put together a registry of over 3,000 patients and 4,000 injections of this. And this is an off-label use, right? Because this agent is approved for iron supplementation. It's not really approved as an imaging agent, but it's used by a lot of radiologists as an off-label way of doing angiography. And in this paper in Radiology, they looked at neonates all the way to the elderly and saw no severe life-threatening reactions. They had a less than 2% adverse event rate, of which 90% of those were considered mild and 10% moderate. And in my own experience, I'll tell you, I really like this stuff. I mean, I haven't seen any problems at all in several hundred patients that we've done.
What dosing regimen are you using with this? So I know you don't bolus it. So I guess you just kind of inject it very slowly. And really, because of the half-life, you can inject it, go to lunch, come back and image the patient. But so, you know, what dose? And again, I assume it's very slow injection.
Right. Well, what we do is we take a dose, and it is,
I'll help you with this.
It's either 0.8 or 0.9. Go ahead, Howard.
Wait. No, I do it again. How about if I do
down,
this part?
I wrote down 0.08.
Hold on, Howard.
We
can
help you here, brother.
Come on, help us out here. We're getting into math.
All right. So, we use this a fair amount at the University of Wisconsin, for example, to rule out pulmonary emboli in pregnant patients and other situations. The typical dose that we use is 3 milligrams per kilogram of body mass. Doses of 1 to 5 milligram per kilo are common, and we don't go beyond one bottle, which is 510 milligrams. We are careful to first dilute that up. So we administer, a 7 ml dose of ferumoxytol should be diluted in 28 ml of normal saline to a total volume of 35 ml, for example. And as Jeff pointed out, there's a black box warning from the FDA about injecting this at least fast, but it does seem to have a pretty good safety profile. And we've had very good luck with this.
Well, I think that's actually some excellent information. Jeff, any final thoughts? I think we're kind of about ready to wrap this up here.
Right. Well, what we do is, you know, because of that black box warning and administering very, very slowly, we take the dose of ferroheme, which we do on a body mass. We have a special calculator. It takes into height and weight because we're trying to get a constant intravascular dosage. And what we do is we dilute that in, say, 50 or 100 mLs of saline. And, you know, while before the patient even gets to the scanner, we just have them lie in a nice little chair and slowly drip this in over 15 minutes. And I think that's one of the ways you can make this agent very, very safe.
Well, it sounds like the way we used to, what was that iron agent we used to use for liver imaging years ago? I'm blanking on the name of
Feridex,
it.
Feridex. And we injected Feridex, it over Feridex. 30 minutes, and it gave them extreme back pain.
Yeah,
sorry, from memory, that's what we gave them a lot of it. So I'm not sure what Jeff or Howard has to say about that, but I know at Emory, that's how we injected that. And it wasn't on the market too long.
Yeah, luckily, I'd never seen that with ferroheme.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. No, I've never heard of anything like that with ferroheme. He was just bringing up that and the Feridex. So, yeah, absolutely, I've not heard of that either.
I've got a quick question for you, Jeff, with, you know, whole body screening, like, you know, for Lee Fraumeni patients who are at special risk for tumors. Has anybody looked at ferroheme for that? It seems like it'd be a good way to go because those tumors can occur in, you know, breast and soft tissue and brain and so forth. And we screen these patients about once a year with whole body MR, but we're using, gadolinium, and they have a special protocol for it. But just curious if you've done any of that sort of whole body work.
I've done some whole body work, particularly for leiphyromania as well. And we've typically taken the approach of not using contrast for that and really relying heavily on both T2 and diffusion. I think there's a lot of potential for things like Faraheme there. I think the thing we don't really understand about that agent is, because it's much more of an intravascular agent, are we going to enhance tumors the same way we would with regular gadolinium agents? And maybe you have some experience with that. I mean, I find it an agent that's fabulous for vascular imaging, and I just don't really know its characteristics for imaging soft tissue and tumor anywhere near as well.
Yeah, and we've been doing the body part first with and without contrast with the standard 0.1 millimole per kilo of gadobenate or multihance. And then we just get post-contrast images in the brain, from that was administered for the body part. And that's been very, very good. And, something like 10% of these people will turn up with a new tumor as you image them year by year.
Well, guys, I hate to bring this to an end. This has just been a really fabulous talk here with everyone. Jeff, thank you again for joining us. We greatly appreciate your insights, man.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
I really enjoyed talking to you guys.
Yeah, it's been great seeing you. Howard, as always, it's just... I was trying to think of a fancy word, and I can't do it. It's just a freaking pleasure, okay?
I just hope everyone is gruntled with this and not disgruntled.
I've got my dictionary waiting on me right now, so I'm in big vocabulary overload right now, okay?
We're ahead of the curve on some of this.
Yeah, well, that's definitely a good time to bring this to an end. So again, folks, this episode was sponsored by an unrestricted educational grant from Bracco Diagnostic. We really appreciate their support. So Jeff, Kristen, Howard, thanks again. Thanks to everybody out there. That's it. We're done. So you're just going to have to get over it. Talk to you next time. You've been listening to MRI Cast, produced by William Faulkner and Associates and Northwest Imaging Forums.